So my darlings, welcome. There's so much I have to say and to not say tonight. It's funny, we're small, we're old timers tonight, so part of me thinks, save the words for another night. Which is kind of perfect because my recorder, the memory is full. I didn't. And you know, it's so interesting, when I transferred last week's files onto my computer, that inner voice of knowing said, you should remove some stuff. I didn't, but of course, the inner voice of knowing knows. It's the voice of unknowing, and it knows. So I'll record on the iPhone and hope we don't run out of battery power there. It's so interesting, because I made a point of charging this thing so it wouldn't run out of juice. I love it. This is life, you know? Just when we think we have it all figured out, the bottom falls out. Keeps us fresh and new and young. Young at heart, if not young of body. So maybe I'll compromise, because I did have so much to read and talk about tonight. When I was editing the talk from last week over the weekend, it's so funny at the end when I say I'm not going to read it, everybody cracks up laughing. I left that on the, I left it in. In fact, it was so lovely. I left it at the end of the Dharma talk, and I put it at the beginning of the chanting also. I think the laughter of this class is my favorite part of class. Anyway, so he's writing about a meeting with Mother Teresa. And he writes, people we meet, some great in the eyes of the world and some almost invisible to the larger society, are often conduits of God's wisdom. Now, I just want to say, for people who don't believe in God and for whom, how can I say, traditional religious metaphors don't really work for you, just you want to read between the line and understand when he's talking, what he calls God's wisdom is what we call the luminosity of the self. It's like, don't get caught in small understanding. So again, he writes again, people we meet, some great in the eyes of the world and some almost invisible, are often conduits of God's wisdom. When I met Mother Teresa during a visit to Rome, I saw immediately that her inner attention was focused only on Jesus. And through him, she came to see the poorest of the poor, to whom she dedicated her life. Now, in the yoga, the language of yoga, we would call that the Shiva Drishti, right? That's the vision of Shiva. That's what we call it, Sahaj Samadhi, Samadhi with open eyes. That's seeing all of creation as a pulsation of the divine. It's all the same. It's all the same. When ordinary social, psychological, or medical questions were brought to her, she did not answer them on the level they were raised. Instead, she addressed them with a divine logic and from a spiritual place and perspective that remains unfamiliar to most of us. Right? She responded from the big, from what a dear friend of mine always used to call the unsmall, the great self. And most of us are just caught in the limitation of ego, story, agenda, your friends, the citta vrittis. And so we don't hear and we don't respond from the vast upsurge of consciousness, which he's calling divine logic. That is why many found her ways simplistic, naive, and out of touch. Like Jesus, she challenged her listeners to move with her to that place where things can be seen as God sees them, and to look beyond the surface to the place of divine encounter or call. It's so profound, the notion of seeing. in the language of this tradition as God sees. Again, that's what we would call the Shiva Drishti. It's moving back into what in yoga we call witness consciousness, and seeing and receiving and experiencing life from that place of the witness, not from the limited sense of I. In my case, I had asked her for advice on what to do about my spiritual distractions and temptations. Right? This is what we all put ourselves through. I'm watching too much TV, I'm going out too much, whatever it is. I'm not getting up in the morning and meditating, whatever our spiritual distractions and temptations may be. I'm shopping too much, whatever it is. I ate too much chocolate, whatever it is. After she listened to my unique complications, because we all think our complications are so unique, and elaborate explanations of the trials of my life, right? We're also caught up in the trials of our lives. Each one of us is like an Oscar contender for the Drama Queen Award, right? She burst my bubble by saying simply, well, when you spend 1 hour a day adoring your Lord and never do anything which you know to be wrong, you will be fine, right? What we would say is, yeah, if you just spend 1 hour a day with your breath, you'll be fine. Her response startled me. I had expected her to diagnose and discuss my very pressing questions. But I suddenly realized that I had asked questions from below, what we would call above, and she had given an answer from above, what we would call below, pointing me in the direction of divine presence. She knew that even if I better understood my distractions and problems, something else remained, right? That's what they say in understanding is the booby prize, right? We can psychoanalyze ourselves from now till the cows come home, but we're not going to touch into the divine encounter with what we call the self. She knew that even if I better understood my distractions and problems, something else remained, a call to live closer to the heart of God. At first, her answer didn't seem to fit my questions, because we want, it's like the ego wants, well, yes, you must start getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and meditating for an hour. Well, you must discipline your mind. Well, you must whatever. No. You must love yourself, right? You must pause and step back into yourself. At first, her answer didn't seem to fit my questions, but then I began to see that her answer came from God's place of healing and not from my place of complaints. I love that. God's place of healing and not my place of complaints. And it's so true. That's one of the many reasons that I try to keep my talking to a minimum in class. I often fail at that, but I try because I know it's so much more about the experience of practice. And I can talk until the cows come home, but that can be a distraction into the complaints. It's very tantalizing to the mind, the ego. The ego would much rather listen to me or whoever, blather away about all kinds of wonderful things. But it's in that confrontation with our own inner being that the magic happens. Getting answers to my questions is not the goal of the spiritual life. Getting answers to my questions is not the goal of the spiritual life. Living in the presence of God, or what we would say living in the presence of presence, is the greater call. This book is called Discernment, and he's writing about how do we be discernment. The gift of discernment is the ability to hear and see from God's perspective and to offer that wisdom to others. And again, it's that stepping back into what we would call witness consciousness, and coming from that place, then discernment is possible. So a little bit from this lovely book. So I was kind of in this Christian mystic mode, and then I checked my email. My Sacred Poetry website sends me a rather long poem from St. John of the Cross. So I don't want to read the whole thing because it's too long, but let me just read you a little bit. Maybe I'll read more next week. He writes, I came into the unknown and stayed there unknowing. Right? That's what we do. The unknown, that's Shiva consciousness. That's the mystery. That's the inner self. I came into the unknown and stayed there unknowing, rising beyond all science. Now, the person who sends these emails is a very astute man, and he always writes a little commentary on the poems, which I never read. But today I thought, I think I'll read it. And he quibbles, and I think he's correct, with the use of the word science, which is a literal translation of the Spanish word, but actually, in the broader meaning, it's really logic. And in the old archaic meaning, which is when John of the Cross was writing, he's really speaking about logic versus the mystery. So the translator used the word science, and I will use that word as I read, but understand, it's not science. It's the logic of mind that is useful when it's properly used, but is an obstacle to the unknowing. For instance, when the unknowing said to me, you better empty some files off your recorder, and the science said, oh no, I don't have time, here we are. I did not know the door, but when I found the way, unknowing where I was, I learned enormous things. But what I felt, I cannot say, for I remained unknowing, rising beyond all science. That's right? We don't, you know, we sit down to meditate, and sometimes grace happens, and that portal is there. And instead of drawing back, we move through. I did not know the door, but when I found the way, unknowing where I was, I learned enormous things. But what I felt, I cannot say, for I remained unknowing, rising beyond all science. Because when we're in the unknowing, that is knowing, the experience is ineffable. It cannot be contained in words. That's why I read so much poetry, because I find a great poet touches that place, and the poem contains the shakti, the pulsation, the spanda of that living, breathing yesness. And so I find the poems that I read have touched me in that place, and the hope is they will touch you in that place. It was the perfect realm of holiness and peace. In deepest solitude, I found the narrow way, a secret giving such release that I was stunned and stammering. Yeah? And it is, you know, the narrow way. We talk in yoga, we talk about walking the razor's edge. It's the same experience. It is. It's the narrow way because it's like that bottleneck that we have to just wander blindly through, and then the whole thing breaks open into that huge, spacious, as the sky expands. I'll just read one more. And he who does arrive collapses as in sleep, for all he knew before now seems a lowly thing. And so his knowledge grows so deep that he remains unknowing, rising beyond all science. So the experience when we slip into deepening states of meditation, and he who does arrive collapses as in sleep, for all he knew before now seems a lowly thing. It's like we wake up and all the complaints that seemed so important yesterday are now just, they don't even exist anymore. And so his knowledge grows so deep that he remains unknowing. So I'll read more from John of the Cross next week. But I, from this particular poem, I came into the unknown, it's called. But just in closing here, so then I was completely gaga over John of the Cross, who I haven't read in quite a few years. So then, we do love Google. It's such an amazing tool. So I Google. I remembered I used to know of a book called The Cloud of Unknowing, that I thought maybe that was St. John of the Cross. It's not. It's another Christian mystic. But I Google The Cloud of Unknowing, since he's working with the metaphor of the unknown. And Mahamrityunjaya is so much delivering an experience of that huge mystery that we can also call the unknown or the unknowing. So good old Wikipedia is so funny. Had a very lovely essay on the cloud of unknowing. And I don't really like the translations. It's written in Old English. What is it called again? The same thing the Canterbury Tales is in. What is that called?
Middle.
And the translations are just like Victorian English, so not very good. But this I thought was very, very lovely. And again, you have to excuse the patriarchal language, and again, just don't let the language that turns you off turn you off, and just get what it's saying. So he writes, and again, this is like a medieval mystic, anonymous. Nobody even knows for sure who wrote this text, and yet it's so amazing. For he can well be loved, but this is talking about God, the infinite. For he can well be loved, but he cannot be thought. By love he can be grasped and held, but by thought neither grasped nor held. And therefore, though it may be good at times to think specifically of the kindness and excellence of God, or in our case to work with the images and the metaphors, and though this may be a light and a part of contemplation, all the same, and in the work of contemplation itself, it must be cast down and covered with a cloud of forgetting. And you must step above it stoutly but deftly with a devout and delightful stirring of love, and struggle to pierce that darkness above you, and beat on that thick cloud of unknowing with a sharp dart of longing love. And do not give up, whatever happens. This is bhakti yoga on steroids. For he can well be loved, but he cannot be thought. How many times have we said that? By love he can be grasped and held, but by thought neither grasped nor held. And therefore, though it may be good at times to think specifically of the kindness and excellence of God, and though this may be a light and a part of contemplation, all the same, in the work of contemplation, what we would call meditation itself, it must be cast down and covered with a cloud of forgetting. And you must step above it stoutly but deftly, with a devout and delightful stirring of love, and struggle to pierce that darkness above you, we would say inside you, and beat on that thick cloud of unknown with a sharp dart of longing love, and do not give up whatever happens. It's so amazing. It's such a testament to the power of the human spirit. It's such a teaching on determination in the face of struggle and demons and pain and loss and longing and bad stories and rotten history and all the stuff, all those complaints that we wrestle with when we come from the place of the small. But we want to apply that Shiva drishti. We want to step back into that huge eye of unknowing that is knowing. It's a knowing that's so sure of itself, it doesn't have to know anything. It's a knowing that's beyond fear. and doubt. It's a knowing that doesn't need to be liked or respected, validated, recognized. It doesn't need any external props to stand in its glowing luminosity. And that, when we are working with a mantra like Mahamrita Jaya, so we're very much in the realm of the metaphor called Shiva, that's Shiva consciousness. The same thing all these Christian mystics were talking about. And when we shift into a Devi Sai, it'll be the same thing we're talking about. It's always the same pulsation of the mystery. So I've been thinking so much about the metaphor, the vision, the image of Shiva as spacious as the sky. And I've spoken this phrase to you so many times over the years. I've always found it very evocative. But I was thinking this week, do we really have a clue what that is? It's a beautiful phrase, but does it really speak to us? And I think it's very, very good to just really reach into the contemplative depths of your being and really feel the possibility of that internal spaciousness that is spacious as the sky, you know. And why do we even want that? Why do we even talk about it? Because when we're in that spaciousness, all those complaints dissolve, right? Everything dissolves into the spaciousness. Everything dissolves into the blazing fire of the great heart. It's so easy for us to get lost in mind pictures, all the lists. We all have so many endless to-do lists. So I want to try a meditation with you tonight before we chant, and then we'll chant again.